current state on WKAR, the Michigan Capital Region's weekly radio magazine of all things across our state. I'm your host, Peter Worf. President Donald Trump embraced legislation this week that would dramatically reduce legal immigration and shift the nation toward a system that prioritizes merit and skills over family ties. Trump joined with Republican Senators David Perdue of Georgia and Tom Cotton of Arkansas to promote the bill, which has so far gained little traction in the Senate. Perdue and Cotton's legislation would replace the current process for obtaining legal permanent residency or green cards, creating a skills-based point system for employment visas. The bill would also eliminate the preference for U.S. residents, extended and adult family members, while maintaining priority for their spouses and minor children. Overall, immigration would be slashed 41% in the legislation's first year and 50% in its 10th, according to projection models cited by the bill's sponsors. The bill would also aim to slash the number of refugees in half and eliminate a program that provides visas to people from countries with low rates of immigration. Michigan Economic Center Director John Austin told WKAR News that such a policy would mean trouble for Michigan.
If it weren't for legal immigrants in Michigan, we would have had no population gain. We would still be losing population in the last decade, if not for a 25% increase in our 650,000 legal immigrant population. We would have still lost people when Governor Snyder has made growing Michigan's population to 10 million one of the goals before he leaves office. And it's important for folks to understand our immigrants are well-educated. They are much more likely to be starting a new business and be an entrepreneur. They're responsible for hundreds of thousands of other Michiganders being employed in the businesses they create. And they're disproportionately the doctors, the engineers, the technology workers that we rely on in Michigan and that we need as talent if we're going to grow new jobs and be participating in a healthier economy in the future. Michigan uniquely was built by migrants who came here to mine the ores, to plow our fields, to then build our great industries from all over the world and all over the country. And the latest wave of immigrants have been the only source of new economic activity and new population growth in our communities that we have. So we're uniquely a state built by immigrants and migrants, all seeking a better life. The same things that the Poles and the Finns and the Dutch and the Germans sought to make a job, get a good job, build community, raise their family. That's what today's Middle Eastern or Salvadoran or Asian, Pakistani and Chaldean or Bangladeshi is looking for. But their immigrants are the drivers of our population growth. We have seen a population growth in Michigan, but only because of immigrants. We still have lost our folks who were born here who leave out of state. We've seen immigrants are entrepreneurial. 31,000 firms employ 150,000 other immigrants. 28%, more than a quarter of all the Main Street businesses that you see on the main streets of our communities are immigrant-owned and operated. That's revitalizing neighborhoods. As I indicated, innovation, new patents, new technologies, three-quarters of all the patents issued by our top universities, University of Michigan, Michigan State, all of three-quarters of them are immigrants who are making the innovations that are creating new businesses. And a third of all the students at our universities, like Michigan State University, who are studying science and technology and engineering and math, and 40% of our graduate school enrolled candidates for PhDs in those hard disciplines are immigrants. And again, 32,000 international students have been contributing $1 billion to Michigan's economy by spending their money here. And we, when they stay, and we'd like them to stay, not chase them away, they create new jobs for other people because they're working and or starting a business in these high-tech and growing fields. So immigrants are unique contributions to our talent pool, our new innovations and high-tech startups and new businesses and to revitalizing communities that have often lost a lot of people and certainly lost a lot of our young people.
John Austin of the Michigan Economic Center reacting to President Trump this week backing GOP legislation to restrict legal immigration to the United States. Years ago this week, Detroit, Michigan was still reeling from days of violence and destruction throughout the city. Inside the Charles Wright Museum of African American History, curator Petrina Chatman decided to take a different path when it came to addressing the 1967 rebellion which shook the museum's home city of Detroit. WKAR's Jamie Paisley takes us to the museum to meet Petrina Chatman.
Instead of doing a traditional exhibition, we decided to use art to tell that story. We found artists who had the presence of mind to actually create art during the rebellion. They selected items that were on the ground, that was glass, burnt objects, and they created wonderful works of art that helped to tell that story. And through those pieces, you can imagine how big, how mammoth it would have been to be extraordinarily scary, because I was one of those who was actually running around during that period, but how scary it was to be at that time. Fires everywhere. And so these are the items that we selected.
The exhibit called Say It Loud, Art, History, and Rebellion at the Wright Museum is split into two sections. The first is located outside the museum and features billboards on display 24/7. Which show pictures and quotes from the time surrounding Detroit in 1967. Inside, past the dome of the museum, is the art installation itself, taking up a couple of galleries and cataloging the oppression and the pride of African American artists, both contemporary and of the 1967 era.
People tend to think of history exhibitions as things that's just in the past.
Juanita Moore, president and CEO of the Charles Wright Museum.
And we wanted people to see that this is something that is very active and ongoing and very present in our lives right now. And oftentimes, art can speak to people in ways that other things cannot. Artists find ways. They incorporate the things that move people, like music and poetry and spoken word and beautiful visual images. So we wanted people to be able to experience all of that and understand that, you know, exactly what happened in 67 in Detroit is an opportunity for us. As painful as it was, as disturbing as it was, and sometimes as hard as it is for people to relive, but it's also an opportunity for us to see our way to a better future.
As for the title of the exhibit, that's best summed up by curator Petrina Chatman.
Say It Loud by James Brown, I'm Black and I'm Proud, became an iconic song for the Black Power movement and is still used today. Well, that is inspired the title for our exhibition. One, we're trying to say it loud, even now, that these are some of the similar concerns that are in our community today. We are becoming a model city, but we have to make sure that everybody is part of that city. So Say It Loud, through art, history, and rebellion, helps us to understand not only what happened in the past, but how we can make sure it doesn't happen today and in the future.
Say It Loud, Art, History, and Rebellion is on display at the Charles Wright Museum of African American History in downtown Detroit now through January 2nd. Visit WKAR.org to get a link to the Wright Museum's website as well as a preview of some of the work on display. For WKAR, I'm Jamie Paisley.
From remembering rebellion to recovery and relocation. Dr. Kirk Heinze of MSU Today's Greening of the Great Lakes takes us now to Rosa Parks Boulevard in Detroit to meet with Senior Pastor Reverend Faith Fowler of the Cass Community United Methodist Church to talk about building new homes for people in the neighborhood, tiny homes.
So we've started building 25 tiny homes, 250 to 400 square feet, for formerly homeless people, senior citizens who are low income, and students who've aged out of foster care. The idea is that they'll rent the homes. Each one is different, and each is on its own individual lot, so 30 by 100 feet, roughly. People will rent for 7 years based on square footage. So a dollar a foot, 250 square foot house, you pay $250 a month, $300, $300, $400, $400. If they stay for 7 years and participate in the program, so there's financial coaching and homeownership classes and some volunteering requirements. At the seven-year mark, we will ask them to join a new homeowners association and give them the property, the deed, and the house.
Now, a lot of people are wondering about these tiny homes in terms of hookups, amenities. I mean, how do these tiny homes compare to a more traditional home other than smaller size?
That's it. It truly is a real home. It has electricity and water and heat and air conditioning and all the appliances you would expect. We've built them to be very attractive, which is not the norm with low-income housing, and distinctive so that people have pride in their homes. But most of them have tall ceilings and lots of light, lots of windows to give you the impression that you're in a much larger space and a cozy space, not a, a cramped or crowded area.
Well, I can think of all kinds of questions, but let's just start with, why did you decide to get into this? As I understand it, there's sort of it's a national phenomenon, but not so prevalent in Michigan. I mean, how did you get into it, and why did you get into it?
So we were looking at helping people who are poor have an asset. They have an income. They may be paid minimum wage or have part-time or SSI. They have to make at least $10,000 a year, but that's it. They don't have to make any more, and they can be a homeowner in 7 years. The idea was that even though they have money coming in, the first time they have a crisis, they're in trouble again. They're homeless again, or they're in trouble in terms of falling behind on rent and their bills. So with an asset, they'll be able to get a traditional loan that they haven't been able to receive in the past. They're able to sell it and buy something else if they want. Should they die, and we all will, I would point out, they'll have something to leave their children. And when you're poor, that's rarely the case. Usually, you're leaving debt. the family struggles for a way to bury the person who is deceased. So this really changes things not only now but generationally. It has the ability to give people economic mobility.
In addition to the rent that they pay, then the other bills, most people would have, if they have phones, would have mobile phones. So we're talking about heat and electricity primarily?
Yeah, the only bill they have to pay during the seven-year rental period is electricity, which includes heat. But because we've done the best insulation you can in terms of spray-in, and we've got really good R ratings on our windows, the heat and electric bill in the coldest winter here in Michigan should be $35 or less per month.
The other question that naturally comes to mind, these people are renting the home, so there will be a cash flow back, but you had to have some resources to build these homes in the first place. How's that happening?
So the money is raised up front to build the homes. The money that comes in for rent really accommodates the ongoing bills, taxes, security, water, that sort of thing. We've raised all the money privately. There's not a government nickel or dime in it. So the Ford Motor Fund, the R&R Foundation, the Community Foundation, the McGregor Fund, as well as many, many churches and the Junior League of Detroit. So people have really stepped up. It's almost like a barn raising. They come as volunteers. They come and give us materials. They've certainly given us a great deal of money to make this happen because everybody understands what it's like to have or maybe not have a home.
How does the application process work? I would imagine you have great demand for a limited number of homes.
Yeah, because the response has been so tremendous. I mean, from all over the country, I had a woman arguing with me about why can't she get a home from Florida. We advertised it for the month of October. We took in 122 completed applications, and then we cut it off. We only have 25 homes, so to go through 1,000 applications doesn't make sense. And yet we anticipated it would have grown to 1,000 at least.
The first time we did an interview with you, Faith, we talked about several green industries that you've established. One of those would be coasters, et cetera. You've got several. Give us an update on your green industries.
Well, things are selling well. So since the coasters, we've added keychains and Detroit Treads, which is a sandal made out of the rubber. We certainly do document destruction. We began last year making pallet Christmas trees so that people didn't have to cut down all our evergreens. And draft dodgers, which aren't politically connected at all. They simply keep the draft from coming into your home. So we keep adding new and different products. And last year we actually established a catalog, and it's brought in robust sales.
Well, for our listeners who may have missed that first interview several years ago, I mean, who are the workers in these green industries? How are they recruited? How are they compensated? Tell us about that.
Sure. So we hire formerly homeless men and women to work most of the jobs in green industries. They start at slightly more than minimum wage. And most of them start between 20 and 30 hours a week. It helps them have a little money in their pocket, gives them somewhere to go, helps them establish a resume and reference in case they're ready to go somewhere else. The other group that we target in green industries are developmentally disabled adults who perhaps have limited education or are limited in what they can read or write or count or that sort of thing. So they handle most of the document destruction. So sensitive paperwork from doctors and lawyers and accountants, they shred it, and then we sell it to a paper mill in Wisconsin. And that business has been doing fairly well as well.
Well, in terms of your mass and your Detroit Treads, the last time we talked, you were gathering up tires all over the city of Detroit. I mean, is that still going on? Or hopefully, with all the renovation going on in Detroit, there are fewer of these tires laying around. But what's the situation?
So we've picked up 95,000 tires so far, and there are more to collect, unfortunately. There's ample supply coming in. I mean, the mayor's doing a fine job in terms of bringing houses down and cleaning up properties, but unfortunately there's still a tire issue.
Let's talk a little bit about, from 50,000 feet, there's a lot of talk in Detroit and outstate and nationally about this renaissance that's going on in Detroit. Mm-hmm. And from your perspective, I mean, you're on ground zero, essentially. I mean, what is your take on Detroit's renaissance? Is it cosmetic? Is it real? Is it some combination of both? How do you see it?
It's real, but it's limited geographically at this point, that downtown, midtown, Corktown are all doing really well. You never would have imagined 10 years ago the businesses moving in, the residents moving in, the cleanup and the renovation of buildings, the construction of new stadiums and other buildings, right? So those areas, truly it is a world-class city again, or moving in that direction. The neighborhoods, however, haven't had near as much attention, and consequently, they're lagging behind. For instance, where we're sitting right now, our zip code has a 44% rate of people living in poverty. I mean, that's third world, you know? I mean, so much more work needs to be done in the neighborhoods, and it's not that people are saying they won't do it. They just, you have to take it a step at a time.